Our aim is to foster the dialogue between Europe and the United States. And once again, actually, we found the perfect project to do it tonight, thanks to Christian Rottemeier, the curator of the Department of Drawing at the Museum of Modern Art. And I want to welcome him and thank him for, first of all, publishing this wonderful book and agreeing to present it here at the Swiss Institute. It means a lot to us. And I want to thank the artists, Lawrence Wiener, that we know a little bit at the Swiss Institute by now, but as well, Raphael Ferrer and Keith Saunier. It's a pleasure to have you here tonight. And I'm really honored and excited because the subject of tonight's talk are two exhibitions, and I love exhibitions, and they are somehow a very volatile good, and they kind of fly away. And if there wouldn't be people that would catch them and bring them back, actually, in a very precise way, maybe they would just stay rumors. And I think it's always beautiful when shows are rumors and survive as rumors over decades. But on the other hand, I think it's also very precious to actually see and analyze these exhibitions and to try to understand how actually they were created, but also how they resonated over all this time. I want to also thank Piper Marshall, who initiated, actually, with Christian, the tonight's talk. And just a little remark, Roman Signer, the current artist that we show here, he was 31 years old, and he was kind of a late starter. And one of the most important shows he saw as a 31-year-old guy in Bern was When Attitudes Become Form. And I think it was really a crazy, fuzzy exhibition. Actually, if you look at the catalog, you can't really tell what it was about because it's a mere collection of leaflets. And yeah, I think after tonight, we're all going to know a lot more about two shows, because I think the great thing about the book is it's not only about a rumor getting materialized, but much more almost a scientific approach to compare two exhibitions from 1969. My Dutch is not very good. Op losses groven, I guess. As los groven. See? Thank you very much for coming, and please welcome our panelists tonight.
Much better. Well, first of all, Gianni, Piper, Moni, everyone at the Swiss Institute, thank you very much for hosting this. This has been, I think, an event in one way or another, I want to say for me, 10 years in the making, for some in this room, probably 40 years in the making, maybe. But sort of in seriousness, you know, a little over 3 years of work, and I'm really happy to bring a very iconic and important part of Swiss history back to Switzerland in the U.S., in New York, in Soho, where in a way both of these exhibitions began. And of course, the exhibitions themselves couldn't have been done without the artists. So it gives me great, great pleasure to be able to sit here with Keith, Raphael, and Lawrence to talk about the exhibitions and what came after, because without you, there would be no exhibitions. But I also welcome two people in the audience who I hope you'll be able to meet later over drinks, who are very, very important in very different ways. Lucy Steeds, who was the associate editor at After All Publishers, who really kind of willed the book into being from the side of the publisher and worked with me on the edits and really produced the book in its form that we have it here with us, which I think is really fabulous and much better than I could have ever expected. And we have a a surprise guest, Marlène Bellilos, who in 1969 worked as a journalist for the Télévision Suisse Romande, for the Swiss, the French-Swiss television station, and did a television feature of the installation. And we have two monitors set up in the other room, one showing Marlène's film and the other showing a little snippet of television footage of Oblosses Ruwe, the other exhibition that is the subject of the exhibition. And so in that you will see Lawrence and Keith and Harald Zeman and a couple of other people during the installation and talking about the work then. So I think after this talk you'll have the wonderful opportunity of comparing it with the sort of a report from the time when the exhibition was made. And it's provided me with great archival resource material, and I'm very, very happy that you found your way all the way from Geneva to come here to be with us tonight. Thank you. Without much ado, I want to begin our conversation. I think Johnny put it very succinctly when he said that often exhibitions stay rumors, and I think When Attitudes Become Form might be one of those exhibitions that has become the greatest rumors of all time in exhibition history, in that for so many people it has provided the kind of cornerstone of what a great exhibition is. It's become this sort of, you know, if you talk to any curator of my generation or the generation before, Harald Zeman has become the sort of lodestar of a curatorial model, and it begins with When Attitudes Become Form. But actually, very little has been published about the exhibitions after the original exhibition catalog has come out. And Oblosses Ruwe is a very interesting kind of lining of When Attitudes Become Form, because it happened in its organizational process entirely in parallel. 90% of the artists are included in both exhibitions. Actually, Harald Zeman published the working diary to When Attitudes Become Form in the catalog of Oblosses Ruwe, which is a very bizarre detail. Both catalogs make reference to each other. They were reviewed in the press as of a piece at the time. And at the same time, there hasn't been, I think, a single image of the exhibition published outside of a 1996 Art Press Orserie number that says Siegelab edited with wrong captions, where the artists are all misidentified. And there hasn't been but one interview in 95 with Wim Behren about the show. So I think to bring back that exhibition into the consciousness and on an even plane with When Attitudes Become Form was one of the great enterprises that we tried to do with the book. And both or all three, Keith, Raphael, and Lawrence, were included in both exhibitions, which is one of the reasons why I'm so happy that they're here. And but I think they're, or I hope, that your narratives of both shows and your experiences and memories of both will be quite different. And I want to start with Raphael, because when we were talking in advance of this conversation, you said that you actually didn't travel there, but that your memories and your interactions with both curators were based in New York and started in New York. So I thought, what better place to begin but New York City to kind of begin with a conversation about the exhibition? Do you just want to start kind of talking a little bit about how it began from your point of view?
Well, from my point of view, actually, I did not live in New York City. I lived in Philadelphia at the time, and I had a very good, friendly relationship with Robert Morris. And with the friendship that I had with Bob, I got this introduction into what was beginning to develop in New York City. And essentially, my contribution could be titled The Uninvited, because essentially it came about because there was a show at 108th Street the Castelli warehouse, which was the first, absolutely first alternate space or whatever. These things have now become, they're permanent, but at that time it was just a warehouse where Leo kept his inventory, and Bob Morris was instrumental in organizing a show which was called, I think, Nine at Castelli, and Keith and Richard Serra and Bruce Nauman and I believe Bollinger and Alan Saret, there was a whole bunch of
And Giovanni Anselmo and Mario Meritz were in it.
So essentially, that show was the show in a way that you cannot speak about these two shows in Europe without going first to that show. Because after that show, then something that Bob Morris said in conversation, which I thought was very peculiar at that time, but it turned out to be prophetic. He said, actually, critics are not needed anymore. Because once something important happens, everybody knows about it. Now, that sounds like gossip, and it is, but essentially it was also true. So the thing is that when Bob had his show, I had gone to Puerto Rico for vacation that summer. I did not, I wasn't in the city. I was not invited to be in Nine at Castelli. So when he told me with great regret that I couldn't be in the show because already everything was programmed, I decided to do an event that took place in one single day. And that event involved using Philadelphia Leaves and using four of my students at the Philadelphia College of Art to come to New York City with a pickup truck full of bushels of leaves. And the plan was very, very clearly defined by me to the students, which essentially involved going first to 29 West 57th Street, where there were the gallery building where Duan was at the top, and then Fishback and Tibor Denage, and I believe there was perhaps another gallery in the building. And the plan was to fill the elevator with leaves. And we did that very surreptitiously. The emphasis that I had was that simply it could not become a publicity stunt. It had to be something very weird happening. And I won't go into the details of how it developed, but this, essentially what did happen was that I met one of my students in the top floor at Duan. He gave me his bushels of leaves. I had gone up in the passenger elevator. He had gone in the cargo elevator, and I ripped all the leaf bags that I had. Leaves covered me up to my neck, and then the elevator began to go down, and it stopped three times. Every time it stopped, there were people waiting to get on the elevator, and the leaves spilled. The people were intimidated by the leaves, and they did not enter the elevator. We continued down. We went to the bottom, and that was the end of that. Then we went to Leo Castelli Gallery, where there was a beautiful Cy Twombly show, and two of my students went up, and they opened three bags of leaves and deposited this mound of leaves in the center of the gallery. And the odd thing, now talking about retrospect and how things change and develop, one friend of mine who was a photographer who worked for Castelli, who was Ron Miyashiro, was an artist from California. He worked for Castelli and he knew about this, so he wanted to be there. And he said that the secretary came and saw the mound of leaves and she said, oh my God, this should have gone to the warehouse. They deposited here. It's supposed to be here. Later I was told that Leo walked in and he said, oh, this is very beautiful. And he wasn't upset at all. And that, so this story ends with me going then to the warehouse and filling the staircase with leaves and then going to all these parties where all these famous-to-be people were going to at Barbara Rose's place. So because of that, I then was invited to be in Oblosis Roven and in When Attitudes Become Form and subsequent other things. And as I said, it was not something that occurred, but it confirmed what Bob Morris said. When you do something and whatever, then it becomes whatever.
Did at the time, did you meet with either of the curators here in New York subsequently to that?
Yes, I did. And I scanned the book and I read Biren was more simpatico. Seaman had another propensity, which I deciphered when I read the fact that when he walked into Richard Serra's studio, he could smell a great artist. And I suspect that it had to do with the fact that I would never smell because I take many showers. In the tropics, we love the shower. And in the north, they only bathe wherever. I mean, I don't know that that is the real reason. But it's interesting in this book, which you all should get, that Zeman says that he smelled a great artist. Now, you know, that's debatable, but in any case, let's leave that for history. Where were we now?
You were talking about the warehouse show, and I just want to bring that to Keith, because you were in the warehouse show, and it's the one exhibition that both curators saw where the entirety of the group of artists were taken wholesale into When Attitudes Become Form and Oplossesgroeve. And in the case of When Attitudes Become Form, most of the works actually shown in the warehouse show were replicated in the checklist of When Attitudes Become Form. And you were in that exhibition. Had you met Zeman or Baron before, or was this something that came out of that exhibition?
Well, seriously, I can't remember very much about this Castelli show, because I was already working in Europe.
Right.
I showed in Europe before I showed with Leo. So I had met, I had worked in Germany. I had done two shows in Germany, and I had met Zeman before in Europe. So when the Nine from Castelli happened, I already knew Morris because I went to Rutgers and Bob was teaching graduate school there. So we had a dialogue before that, in a way. And I mean, curiously, I can't remember that much about the Castelli show. I did do a show after that at the warehouse, which was really my first show with Leo. The second show with Leo, where I really started to make the much larger works that I was then making in Europe. So the one thing I do remember more than anything about the two shows in Europe was the fact that the art world had the possibility and did become an international art world. And you really sensed it when you were first there, where all of these artists from all the different countries were forced together in this dialogue in language, in work, and just in being. And it was extraordinary. And it really did make one think very differently of New York, because I really had to show in Europe before I could show in New York. Work of my generation was not so accepted in New York. It took a European credence, in a way, for that work to be shown here in New York.
Larry, I want to follow up on that with you, because just earlier, as we were speaking back, you said that one of the interesting things about this exhibition and that moment was that when European curators would come to New York, they were sort of astonished by the fact that all the artists knew each other. And at the same time, it seemed that a lot of the connections then happened back in Europe. Do you want to talk a little bit about that back and forth? Because you then moved to Europe sort of subsequently, not quite immediately afterwards, but
I never moved. No. That's a very strange thing that happens here. We're talking about something that went on 40 years ago. And 40 years ago, maybe things were different. My first going to Europe was in 1963. I was in a show in Paris. I have no idea how I got to Paris. I remember flying to Glasgow on Icelandic Airlines and standing in the airport with the woman that I was traveling with, and two stewardesses coming over and saying, "Were you trying to get to London? Yeah, come with us, we can take you." Got to London, got on a train, went there, and I was in a show that Leon Golub and some other people had put together that was protesting the fact that the peace had been signed in already in Paris, and they were still pulling people out of the Seine, Arab people out of the Seine. And we were in this show by the Santé, by the prison where everybody was held. And from that moment, I met some people from Cobra, and I met some other people, and I had a train pass, and I went around. I came back to New York, and I had to really think about this. I'd spent a couple of, you know, a couple of months traveling around, meeting artists. I'd shown in Firenze, and I'd shown, and they wouldn't let me into Spain. They'd only said that you could cross at Hyundai, because I was on a list from the American government of not being a good person. And no, you could cross into Hyundai. You can have one night in Madrid. I paid no attention. We checked into some cheap hotel. I didn't have money. And the next morning, boom, 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 two men with a piss pot on their head came and said, in perfect English, you've been here, you've seen the Prado, now it's time for you to go on to Barcelona, and from Barcelona, you go on to Firenze on the next train. Got on the train, and did the whole thing. Got back to New York and had to think about this. I met, by chance, because I was part of a scene in New York that was non-academic. These were people, the only people that were even teaching were people who were teaching at the School of Visual Arts, and they were doing it part-time just to keep body and soul together. They had no academic aspirations. And they were quite open. Yes, I do remember Harry Zeman being completely freaked out, and I think Una found something to the fact that he came to New York. He was speaking to people, and he found out that not only did everybody know each other, they'd all fucked each other or been married to each other, and they were still telling other people that so-and-so was an interesting artist, which was not a European model. The model began to change, and it was a social model. I don't really know what happened after that. We all did, as Keith and myself, and we all did what we did. I remember Rafi says he was the uninvited. I was the unwanted. I was the one that all the way back in the 60s, Leo said to me, Lawrence, you know, you're a shoo-shoo of Ellsworth, and this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, but there's no absolute way that you're going to ever make a living. So just, you know, do what you have to do. I sort of was functioning. I only know I was in Oplosa Skrova because Kosher Kaptein, who was Kosher van Brugge, who became Kosher Oldenburg, said to her curator, she was a junior curator, go and find this guy. I don't even know if he has a telephone, which I think we had just gotten one a couple of months before. And he came and we talked and I was in. And I've been working with Seth Siegelaub and with a lot of other artists. And we've been showing. But remember, 0 to 9 already had come out of Vito Conchi's. All of these things, these were not exotic things. I don't know how 40 years down the line to tell people that when I only got on the plane to get to Europe for these shows, and the woman I was living with was at that moment 8 months pregnant, we had no money, but I decided to go. It was because I was involved in the anti-Vietnam and Raymond Dirks from Wall Street Against Vietnam fronted his credit card and got me a ticket to fly me to Amsterdam. I slept on Jan Dibitz's floor. We made these works. Somewhere in the middle, Kismet, whatever, Conrad Fischer asked me to make a show, so I had a place for the 10 days that I didn't have any money for to stay in Dusseldorf. And Kosher came down with me and stayed there. And she was supposed to be my translator, and it turned out she didn't speak German. She spoke really great English and Dutch and French, but not German. But it worked. We got it all together. I went on to Bern, and it was an exciting situation. I remember arriving in Bern because of the flights, and in those days, flights were cheap. And this man with a hat came over and said, you're Lawrence Wiener, and I said, yes, and he said, meet me at this cafe, ask somebody from whatever hotel they give you. They didn't give me a hotel, by the way, in Bern. I had to fight for one because I didn't have a dealer. My dealer was not registered as a regular dealer, so I didn't have a hotel. finally they worked it out and I had a place to sleep. And the man turned out to be Joseph Beuys, whose first words when I met him at this airport were, "Don't tell anybody I do speak English, but please don't say anything." And we met and we talked, and he knew everything I was doing and I knew everything he was doing. And I don't even think we liked each other, but we were involved in an attempt to place into the culture, not to change the culture, because that would mean you'd have an end, to place into the culture another aspect of things. And his humanism was a European humanism, and my humanism, I'm rather afraid, is a very American, New York City, you know, a roof over your head, public school, a hospital, public library, that's about it. We got on, and it worked.
Yeah.
And if you remember, there was no trouble in
Bern. But I do remember that the exhibition was not liked.
Oh, it was detested. My work was called Kunst kaputt.
Yeah, it was really
that,
not liked.
Art that fucks up,
but,
art that breaks things.
I think that as the work matured there, as it, because it was up for a while, I think, the exhibition, it became more and more more important. But at the opening, it was really disliked.
And they threw dog shit all over the Kunsthalle.
Right. Oh, no, they brought like a truckload of manure and deposited
it
in front
threw
of
it
the museum.
On the thing.
And it closed a week early than what it was supposed to be, and right. Zeman resigned basically 2 months later because he was supposed to do a boys show after, and his board pulled the funds and didn't let him. They pulled the funds and didn't let him do the boys show, and then he resigned from
it was
the,
not popular, and what. Nobody, I don't know how to explain this to people. I mean, we're all old farts sitting here except for Christian. But I don't know how to explain this to people, that none of us thought we were doing anything particularly odd. Because
no, we thought it was completely
normal. It was incubating in New York. It was really quite normal. The work we were making had an audience. It had places to show. It had books coming out, catalogs coming out. We didn't understand that this was a cause célèbre. And I still to this day don't.
Well, I think this is a very good example where really it begins with the artists, because Jan Dibitz was the person.
He came in because Willoughby Sharp brought him in for the Earth show, and he met Carl, myself, Robert Ryman put him up.
Right.
And the Italians, it was very important the Italians were there, too, because that really altered the context of the show very much and altered the concept of European art very much. Mm-hmm.
Totally, and it altered the aspiration.
Yes.
Not the concept, because I had already been sort of like invited by Boetti to join the Art de Pauvre people because of something politically or something that I was involved in. But it changed the aspiration. And the problem with art is that art is really not about rules and regulations. It's about aspirations. Non-mystical, non-alchemical, and Raffi, non-ethnic.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, I
it totally
I could not agree
changes
more.
The whole. Yeah.
Ethnic became later. I did not realize that I was an ethnic until someone defined me as an ethnic. Because I thought I was just a person that spoke
silly you.
Spanish and English.
Silly you.
I, in other words, I'm too young. No. Yes, I am too young to qualify as an ethnic. Consequently, within the ethnics, I am not an ethnic. And within
well,
the pures,
we're a culture
I am
ethnics.
Not a pure. Sorry?
We're a culture of ethnics.
Well, yes, absolutely, and this is one of the things I just want to interject. These two gentlemen, who I love dearly for the memories I have of them, I did not meet them in New York, because in New York, my experience was that as an artist, you never said hello to another artist, because you might be then deemed to be inferior. Whereas I met Larry in Amsterdam, and I met Keith in Cologne, and we went and we had a great time. And it was just the thing that unites us tonight is our age and our humanity. The fact that we're still kicking and, you know, full of mischief of every sort that
the thing that unites us, Rafi, is that somebody put our name down on a list that other people use to look at. That's it.
Is that it?
That's it.
Well,
but we maybe deserve to be on the same list. Maybe it becomes like the time I grew up under McCarthy, where if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's a duck. If it walks like an artist and it talks like an artist, it's an artist.
But I was a drummer.
So I was a labor organizer. So
a drummer who was depositing leaves in an elevator,
you hit skins, and I hit skins. Okay.
And that was that.
The thing is, a drummer has a different mind altogether. This is the thing about, I mean, I have a real big problem with a Y, because it's Yale University. And I find that Yale is the guarantee of catastrophe.
Yeah, but why is also Hidalgo?
It teaches you how to.
Why is also Hidalgo? Why is also the male? You know, I have a great problem. You obviate the why and you obviate the problem.
There you are.
Yeah, I mean.
So there. I mean, I didn't even have to translate that. You have it.
I want.
But all of these are not issues about being an artist and working as an artist. These are, you know, these are issues you might have about certain things. But the fact that we did these exhibitions, how long has it been? Maybe 40 years?
41 years.
That we are still making art, and we've sustained a career, and we have an attitude about, we've matured as artists. And I think many artists from that exhibition did. And it did alter how we think about the art world very much. And look at the machine of the art world today because of these early international exhibitions. And we think about art in an international way that was not done so much, especially when it came to contemporary art.
Keith, excuse me one second, but you have to remember that if this conversation is going to mean anything, it's not all about this walk down memory lane or reminiscences. It's about the fact that when the Attitudes Become Form show went to Britain, what happened was you got this graduate school mentality. You got the people who were subsidized to go to school to become artists and take over the culture, and they dropped people out of the Attitude show because they had people who made things like that that were under the British Commonwealth. Charles Harrison threw Bosom out because the work was too close to who he was pushing.
But that was
that's really rather interesting,
fact,
isn't
but that
it?
Was partially due to the fact that Charles Harrison wanted to do a British conceptualism show at the ICA, which
yeah,
he was promised.
Yeah, but he took this show and he threw people out who were doing exactly the same work, because what was so wonderful that happened in our time was that everybody was working all over the world. No faxes. There was not. I mean, they had a fax because you've seen that. That's a thing on the films in the 40s. But nobody had a fax. There was no email. There was no communication. And telephones were so expensive even to put on an exhibition in Vancouver, which Seth and Lucy and other people were doing. We had to be at a place at 5 o'clock in the morning because that was the only time you could afford the telephone call. No, at that particular point in time, we were not about who was unique. It was about who was handling the situation uniquely. Bruce Nauman was handling it well. Bruce was able to sort of stand there. Some of the people, Doug Hubler, myself, was able to stand there. Other people were having trouble because this was an unknown terrain. But it wasn't about who was the person who did green.
Who did?
Green. And who was the person who did white. It was all about something else. It was about what that person's aspiration were. It was not a bad time. It was a pretty damn good time.
But let me focus it in for a moment then. Did you then perceive the both exhibitions differently? Did it, because looking at the contemporary critique, and maybe, you know, we're going back to the comment that critics are necessary at the moment, but that it was perceived very clearly as to some extent, different interpretations of the same moment or of the same spirit, if you will, that that Zeman somehow had a different attitude toward the production, the making, the way in which the works came into being than Behrend. Partially,
let's pop it out. Let's pop it out. And when all the people went to Amsterdam, their intent was to figure out a way with what they found that they were going to be doing for a while, how to make a lifestyle, how to make a life out of it. When you got to Bern, and I already contracted to make a show with Fischer before, in the middle of it all, and I went back to Dusseldorf and made the show with Fischer, it was in Bern how you were going to pop it out. It was a whole different ball game, and I don't know if there's a hierarchy in that, but I do know that Amsterdam, for me, was attempting to find where my lifestyle, making the kind of work that I made, was going to be.
Yeah. I think, actually, the architecture had an effect on the two exhibitions, because in Bern, we were dealing with solid architecture, pretty much, not skin architecture. And in Amsterdam, I mean, there was wallpaper on the walls, and there was hung with elaborate cloth, and it was very difficult to put these works on these kinds of surfaces. I mean, it was like interior decorating.
It was called Hessian.
It was a very different approach because of architecture, and I think because of those two aspects, it did even change a lot of how the artist approached working in these two different situations and opened up a way to work in all kinds of situations.
Is that what determined the choices of works that you put in both
you
exhibitions?
You had to change. Yeah,
because
you had fairly restrained
neon works.
Well, for me, I couldn't do the kind of work I did in Bern in Amsterdam.
Because of that.
It would have ruined all the walls, and they were already so upset. So it was a question of adapting and making something, in fact, work, and that you conceptually can still like illustrate your idea, and you know, that's how it happened.
Yeah, I chose different work for Bern than I did for
Amsterdam. You couldn't have done the same work, actually. Well, you could have. Might have been interesting, actually.
I don't know. We're all acting like this is, we were all such sort of tough cookies out there, but basically, you could have done any fucking thing you want and gotten away with it. It's just that some people chose to do something that they might have been able to get away with, but it was worth doing.
Right.
And that's the difference.
Did the shows change anything for you? Did you feel at the moment or in retrospect that they were the milestones that they have sort of become in art history? Or was it really perceived to be of a continuum of events and participations and activities that, you know, where it basically kind of says Sieglaub's March show and this and Earth Art? And I'm asking all of you, but
let's write it down because I'm rather curious.
Yeah. For me, it did change because I was a studio artist before, and now I worked on location. Mm-hmm. And I began to work on location a lot more. I worked all over, and I would not ship the work anymore. It was cheaper to ship the artist than the work anyway. So I was shipped, and I would, in fact, make the work with material from there, with workers from there, with a dialogue from there. And I think that, of course, changed the working process and expanded the working process. And that was quite healthy in a way. And it allowed me to have a much more expansive career.
Indeed. What Keith just said is a really important factor, because when I was invited to show at Talen in 68 and then later at Talen Cologne in 70, it was the same situation. I was told, we're bringing you over, and then, of course, you'll do all the work on site. You'll get the materials you need, and you'll do whatever you want to do.
Well, it was almost an understanding of that's how you worked. It was part of the deal.
Yes.
Right. I remember the anecdote of Carl Andre showing at Conrad Fischer, and he's showing up, and Conrad Fischer gives him a bucket of paint and says, the quicker you paint the floor, the faster you can install your work.
Right. Yes, it could have been that, too.
The museum show, actually, in my experience, which is totally different from Keith and Larry's, which is that I did not go. I met Biren and I met Zeman in Manhattan. There's a note among the many interesting notes. Zeman's notes are much more like fiction. They're much more interesting because they define, like, supposedly when I met him, it was at the Chelsea Hotel. It was an incredibly cold day, snowing, and there was no heat in the hotel. And then I met with him.
And none of that is true, or?
Well, I don't know if it was true or not. I know it was cold, and I know I met with him, and I know it was the Chelsea Hotel. But the piece that I do remember was the one that was done at the Stedelijk, which essentially was a piece that Biren said to me, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I would like you to buy, I think, 3 or 4 rolls of barbed wire, and fill a room full of them, and every day a curator will come and cut snippets of the barbed wire, and if he doesn't do it, you'll never get the barbed wire out of the room. But that's the only way the piece will not only be eventually disposed of, but it also will be able to change every day.
But it ended up in the pool
in
the back of
the
museum.
It ended up in the pool, and it's a beautiful kind of lyrical aspect to it that I never conceived it would have. And I never did see that picture until you got in touch, and I got the photo of it, because I had never really seen the piece. And to be absolutely honest, I have no idea what it is that the exhibit of mine at When Attitudes Become Form, because I understand from your book that it was exhibited in the schoolhouse,
right,
which I have no idea what the schoolhouse
right, was. Of which there is no photographic documentation.
Right, so in a way, what I did didn't exist or is not there and never was, or maybe whatever. It's part of the whole folklore. It's a period full of that, and I think that's a phenomenon that is somehow forgotten, because so many of the people that did work there, and I think that by coincidence, but also by unexplained situations, I'm sitting with Larry and Keith, and they're two people that have continued doing their work in a trajectory that began a long time ago and has continued to develop within the things that they were faithful to from the beginning. This is not about criticizing or indicting anybody, but essentially that those two shows, in a certain way, were a huge premonition. But they were also a premonition of a lot of disasters, because they were the beginning of a star system that began, the embryon of the star system began already to materialize in those shows.
Well, we could argue that that began with Jackson Pollock and Life magazine.
Anyway,
well, yes.
I'd rather remember the poached trout in Barron, which was very good.
I'm sorry, Pete?
I said I'd much rather remember the poached trout in Barron, that was delicious.
Larry, did it change anything for you to finish the round?
I'm going to sound like an absolute asshole, because, quite frankly, I find the two exhibitions, I'm very pleased to have participated. I find them to have been extremely important because they got enough publicity that people saw the work, but in fact, I never thought of them as being particularly, what do they call that? What's your word? Avant-garde. I never saw them as being particularly pushing shows, because this was the only places that I was ever allowed to show in to begin with.
But then it changed tremendously.
I didn't change anything.
No, but it changed tremendously.
No, they adapted a stage. They found this. They found Howling Wolf, or they found, you know, like somebody out in the street, and they built a stage that accommodated it. I saw the society realizing that all the things that I had thought, which all of the people that I had been around didn't believe, that the people around me, myself, a lot of artists I was interested in, were in fact a positive gesture within the society. We were trying to deal with the relationship of materials that had a real dignity. And they changed, and they kept changing, and they kept changing. And then what happens is, of course, it changes enough, and then you get these poor, sad people from nowhere, and they build these schools, and they give degrees in how to fit into the change. But meanwhile, they forgot the fact that art is something that's totally non-static. And in being non-static, setting up stages, you ran into the problem that Grotowski ran into, and you ran into the problem with all these wonderful people who push things to a limit. They built an academy for it. And the whole purpose of the academy is to present answers, or at the very least, solutions. The whole purpose of art is to continually ask questions. So I found myself not impressed, but pleased as punch, because I met an awful lot of people I never would have met if I hadn't gone to these shows. And then I continued to get invited, but I was, you know, in the middle of it all, I made a commercial show. Sold one piece.
Excellent.
To Wolfgang Hahn.
We had a great afternoon with Kienholz.
Yes.
And that was a memorable thing.
Yeah, and
because Ed Kienholz was somebody that was doing work that is absolutely terrific to this day.
Yeah, it was fine, and his kids, when I had to make a movie in Berlin, turned out to be great babysitters for my kid, which was fabulous. But he never liked much what I did. He liked me.
Well, that doesn't matter. I mean, I think liking you and liking or not liking your work,
I don't think they have anything to do with each
nothing,
other.
Nothing. No. Nothing to do with each other.
No.
Well, I have.
When you wake up in the morning, you can like somebody's job, but you might not be happy that it's them that's there.
I want to, I could continue all night asking you guys questions, but I know you've been sitting here for a while, so I want to open it to the floor to see if there are some questions from the audience. And after that, would ask you all to stay around maybe for a drink and buy the book and, you know, chat in smaller groups. So let's open it to the audience if there are questions from you guys.
That was a problem, wasn't it? Joanne Kaplan, who I was a friend who lived on Mulberry Street at the time, she was in the show, but somehow or other in the listings, it's with the awareness of Joanne Kaplan or something. There were a few people, but they were not very. You were talking about something that already had been solved as a problem in the United States and was not solved in Europe. It's that simple. Let's keep it straight.
It had not been solved, Larry.
But it had been beginning to be solved in New York. In New York, it was beginning to be solved.
No, it was not, Larry.
But it was not solved in Europe. But none of us here invited anybody, so it doesn't matter. The idea that they didn't believe that women made art. I don't know where Lee Lozano was in this. I mean, she was there, and then she wasn't in the show. She was supposed to have been. Eva was in the show.
Eva was in the show. Hannah Darboven was in the show.
Eva was a European.
Unfortunately, no longer with us.
Voilà, je peux. Yes?
Yes.
I try to speak English. If I don't speak well, you translate. I just want to say a word about the. I was there when Kiss and Laurence Wiener was there. With boys and Kienholz and everybody. And I think that you have to imagine the climax in the Kunsthalle and the atmosphere and the, comment est-ce qu'on dit, le sourire, the smile of Zeman. He was convinced that he was doing something really different of what else he has done. And he said, after that, I can't do anything. I have to go and to leave the Kunsthalle and to do something else, because this was the last exhibition I can do in a museum. And the atmosphere, because now we are all a little bit old, Laurence Wiener and Kiss Saunier and myself, but they were all... Heiser and Beuys and all gentlemen of 24, 25. And it was an atmosphere incredible in the Kunsthalle, because when I was there for filming, they were doing the works. And this was incredible. And Zeman says, come, because I was there, I was as a journalist in the Swiss television. I was doing all, filming all the exhibition of Zeman for 9 years. But there, it wasn't just a painting on the, that you have to accrocher donc au mur, on the wall. It was not that at all. It was a sort of atelier of workshop with all the artists that Zeman went in all the world. He says to me, je suis allé chercher, I want to see all the attitudes. That was the one of Dibetz, and that it was an attitude doing something with the beatniks of the West Coast. That was a sort of thinking different.
Yeah, but we're not answering Liza's question about that the attitude hadn't changed. It was beginning to change in New York. It hadn't changed about the fact that female people also made art. We're ignoring that. The attitude had not. You're not answering her question about why, in fact, since there probably were more female artists in the United States, especially, than there were male. Why they were not represented within these shows. The shows are important. It's not to demean the show, but that's an interesting question, but it's not a political question. It's a sociological question.
I don't know. Just one mot. No, I don't know if it was for Zeman. It was artistic. It was artistic. He just wanted to make a big exhibition.
Did change the concept of him working in a museum. And of course he couldn't go back because il a dépassé les limites. You know, it went on to something else. It was for him something that he couldn't go back to that old state.
If you would use the microphone, please.
Lawrence, you're talking, is it on?
Yes, I can hear you.
But it goes to my mouth, okay. No, I mean, this goes back to women. I mean, you know, things weren't changing.
Hold it close, please.
At that time. They weren't. I mean, it was a much longer time until it began to change, and I don't know that it's changed yet. So, I have a question.
Johnny, you had that?
Zeman was part of it. You know, I mean, he, you know, even later on when he was doing Documenta, he wouldn't come, he wasn't interested in, he would not come and see women's work, you know, he just, if he knew you were a woman, he just wouldn't even.
You mean Harry Zeman?
Harold Zeman, yeah. I mean, this is much later, so, I you know.
Yeah, but that was, the funny part is that seemed to have been the problem of the people who had taken power and gained position, but it wasn't the situation on the field, it wasn't the situation in the field, but it didn't work. It didn't work, and it still hasn't worked, and it either goes one way or the other way. And it has nothing to do with the artists, that's the problem. We're all just sort of like the people who line up on the corner to be picked up by suburban people to go and fix their lawns. In fact, that's really how artists function, and it'll never change.
I don't think I function that way.
I do, and I brush my teeth before I stand on the street.
Hello. Right. I don't want to talk too long about this, but just on the women's issue, it took demonstrations, it took Lucy Lippard. It didn't really happen until, I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact date, but it was the early 70s at the Whitney Biennale. And I distinctly remember the time when at Max's Kansas City, which was the major hangout for artists of the period on 17th and Park, the situation changed from it being all male artists to a time when the women artists were accepted at their tables and could share the conversation. And, you know, there's no way, no one will back you, Lawrence, I'm sorry. In 1969, the feminist consciousness was not at the levels of the curators. Of course, amongst male artists, sure, they recognized, some of them recognized women artists, and there was a lot of you know, dialogue and so on. But it wasn't percolating down to the level of institutions. So
it
I don't think... Not in 1969, not at all. No. And even in Avalanche, I'm sorry to bring
up my say, I wasn't saying that it had gotten any better. I said that, that amongst the art world, and no. I don't consider it in those days, in 1969, we didn't consider curators as part of the art world.
Oh, okay.
They were the people we worked for.
All right, well, you don't...
Let's keep it that way. Amongst the art world, it was beginning to change.
All right, well, you know, I mean, we're getting to Lewis Carroll territory here.
But I have to say like a shocking thing, but the right to vote for women in Switzerland was established in 1972. And I mean, yeah. So the women didn't have the right to vote in Switzerland during when elitism. That's very embarrassing, but that's the way it was.
Yeah, that's what I meant about the context being so different.
But I try to understand somehow, you know, it's like, what, like, I really try to understand on the art historical level what happened during the 60s. Because on one hand, you have like all these isms in the United States. I mean, the United States take over. They write art history. It's like the most beautiful solo you can imagine. I mean, from pop art to minimal art. And it seems to be all over, you know, almost like in the 20s, where you have like all these isms coming up, and after 4 years it's already bleaching out, and then the next generation comes. But what happens then with the post-minimal generation, and what happens with this bounding back the United States with Europe seems to be really incredible. And I really enjoyed when you talked about maybe also a new, I don't know, you can't say a new lifestyle, but a new way of perceiving the world, you know? And you said it was kind of crucial to learn how to deal with this situation, how to communicate, how to... I mean, you were all inventors. You all invented works. But those works were like highly vulnerable and really hard to communicate to a certain point, you know? And I really tried to understand, like, what happened in the 60s. And for me, it's just like a speed trip that is really hard to get.
Asking
all of you. I was born in 1969, so I have an excuse.
So is my daughter.
I was born in 1933, and in 1898 I became a possession of the United States. The island of Puerto Rico is the oldest colony in the world. There's no argument about that. It's not that it's the worst or the most cruel or whatever. It's coming attractions. I wish I were in the audience, but then I would not be doing what I wanted to do here, which is to join my colleagues and Christian in a conversation about an exhibition. But the question, if we're gonna go into try to remedy slights and cruelties, my question would be, one that art historians are very comfortable when they talk about Rome or Egypt or cultures way in the past. But the question I have today to all American citizens is, which is the art that represents from Reagan until now the United States of America? It is not Larry Wiener. It's not Keith Sonnier.
Is it
I
you?
I am not going further. That is the only thing I want to say. I could go further, but I wasn't asked to come here.
Where did this national shit come from? What? Art does not represent a culture. Art poses a question with whatever culture.
I'm sorry,
no,
my dear.
No, really, Rafi. Art poses a question in whatever culture it happens to wake up and find itself in.
Yes.
It's not... This idea of wearing team jackets, this idea of, you know, young British, German, this, French, American,
let's
that.
Not,
let's
me.
Not get into this.
Excuse
the whole
me.
Point is
excuse
we're
me.
Talking about an exhibition where the only difference was the people who came from the middle class and the people who didn't. because some people had real hotels and other people didn't. That's how those shows got made. And the people that had real hotels are people whose parents went to real schools and they were real people. And the people who didn't have real hotels came from people who didn't come, whose parents went to real schools and were real people. But it's not ethnic. It's not national.
I think what was very interesting about these exhibitions, too, for artists of my generation, we never thought that we could sell work. I never even imagined
that anybody
would buy or that it would even, I was even making it for that. It did change the art world and it did change the art market. And that, I think, is kind of an interesting.
And that is what I am.
But it's interesting
to jump in, Christian. Let me just address what Keith said. Keith worked with flux and latex. Larry worked with language and words and ideas.
Well, I worked with any material that was around.
Yes, and you also
but it doesn't matter what
from businessmen's offices, and you carved,
No, that's not the point,
wall.
But okay, it was all about materials.
Fine.
It wasn't
but what
about
I'm referring to now, when I'm going to insist on repeating, what is the art of the United States Empire, the one that owns Puerto Rico? What is that? The art that now we have artists that need $2 million to make a piece of work. Now, Keith, in his wildest dreams, never thought that he would need that amount of money. And whatever he did...
Oh, I need $2 million.
Oh, yes.
And I want it tomorrow.
Do we have the traveling microphone? There's a question in the front. We're recording this for posterity.
It's not necessarily to relate to these two exhibits because I'm not knowledgeable enough about them, but the whole period of the 60s and the performance works and ephemeral works and performances, etc. And I think there's something that's very... it's an oxymoron between what's happened, what the museums then embraced, or what a show that's bona fide or validated by a museum institution or a curator, and the evolution of how I think it took now until the 90s. I think the 90s artists are a rebirth of the 70s artists, but with the object in mind. And the museums today purchase an ephemeral work on a piece of paper in a box, a packaged proposal is what they purchased today, I think, at least what I've read. So I think that the period and the exhibits, when you ask what represents the art of the Reagan era or whatever, I think that this whole period created something that is the whole, it questions the whole idea of the object and art making and how
yes,
today
indeed.
Object, you don't
indeed.
Need
and where is that spirit? Where is it now? I mean, now installations are de rigueur. You go to school to learn how to install things. I mean, when we were working,
but
they were called pieces. They were not called installations.
Raphael?
They were just pieces.
Keith, since we're moving from the 60s into the present day, I think we all deserve a drink. And so
I do, too, and I don't really understand.
I think we should end it here. I want to thank you very, very much. And stick around, buy a book, have a drink, and continue talking. Thank you.
Thank you.